This episode of Value Hive is brought to you by Tegas. If you enjoy listening to Value Hive, you'll love the Tegas product. Tegas has the world's largest collection of instantly available expert interviews on all the public and private companies that you care about. All you have to do is log in. So if you're tired of high cost and time-consuming expert research calls, give Tegas a try and see for yourself why many of the most trusted and well-respected hedge funds, mutual funds, family offices, allocators, and VCs rely on Tegas to scale their expert research and to get the critical information they need faster than ever. You can sign up for a free trial at tegas.co/valuehive. That's tegas.co/valuehive. And as a personal anecdote, I use Tegas literally every single day. It's the first resource I use when I start researching a new investment, and it's one of the last things I do before I finish up rounding out my research, and I know you'll love it as much as I do. Before we dive into today's conversation, I want to talk to you about MIT Investment Management Company, also known as MITIMCO, the investment office of MIT. Each year, MITIMCO invests with a handful of new emerging managers who it believes can earn exceptional long-term returns in support of MIT's mission. In order to help the emerging manager community more broadly, they created emergingmanagers.org, a website for emerging manager stock pickers. For those looking to start a stock picking fund or those just looking to learn about how others have done it, I highly recommend this site. You'll find essays and interviews by successful emerging managers, service providers used by MIT's own fund managers, essays MITIMCO has written for emerging stock pickers, and more. MITIMCO also occasionally and opportunistically hires new members for their investment team. To view the job description, please visit mitimco.org/global-investor. That's mitimco.org/global-investor. The MITIMCO team spends their time learning about great businesses and investments, working with exceptional investors around the world in order to support generations of MIT innovators. Today's episode is also brought to you by Marhelm Data. Marhelm is an information service for investors to find real value in an overvalued market. With a focus on shipping and commodities, Marhelm helps you stay on the pulse of global trade, track global sentiment, and identify compelling global investment opportunities. ValueHive listeners can get 20% off a Marhelm Data subscription by using the code VALUE at checkout. That's VALUE at checkout. Head on over to marhelm.com, MARHELM.com to get your discount today. All right, Yaron Namark of One Main Capital. I think the last time I had you on the podcast was for the Twitter Spaces with Thunderdome. I think that was the last time you've been on, which was over a year ago. Kind of crazy to think about.
Might have been two or three years ago.
Yeah, might have been 2 or 3 years ago. Now you've got two kids. I've got one on the way. Things are changing. Markets are always fun and exciting. But I wanted to get you on towards the end of the year just to kind of hear your thought process on how you navigated this year, what lessons you've took from it, any mistakes you made, lessons you learned there, any successes that you've had and lessons from those successes, and really just kind of shaping how you're heading into 2024 and maybe some companies, sectors, industries you're looking at in particular. So before we dive into all that, if anyone listening hasn't heard our first episode or the second one, give us a brief background on who you are and how you started your fund.
Okay, cool. Name's Yaron. Founded One Main Capital in early 2018. So coming on 6 years this end of January, which is wild. One Main Capital is a fundamental, long biased, concentrated, quality-focused investment firm in the public equities. Before that, I worked at two hedge funds, and before that, I worked in at a private equity fund. I've been investing for over a decade professionally before launching the fund, and I've really been studying investing my entire life. I grew up to small business owner parents who had a small little business, a store, selling bathing suits and towels and stuff like that to tourists in South Beach. They had friends who had larger, more successful businesses. And so, none of them were college educated, but they barely spoke English, but they were able to make, livings for themselves through business. And some of them became, quite wealthy. And I was always just enamored with how they were able to do that. So all the kids would go play After dinner, I would sit back and listen to their conversations. I started reading the Buffett and Greenblatt stuff very early on. And since then, you know, I've had the opportunity to not only work at firms, but also talk to people and read about people from lots of different styles of investing and develop my own philosophy and style, which has been a lot of fun. You know, I launched the fund in 2018, having never been a portfolio manager before, just a stock picker. And so I've really evolved, I feel like, over the last 6 years, and have really improved not only my ability to pick stocks that work for me and that I think generate good returns, but also manage the portfolio in a way that I think, you know, I'm comfortable with from a risk perspective. And, you know, I'm much more confident today that I could do this for the next 30 years successfully than I was when I first started it. It's been a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to the next 30 years. That's kind of the overview on me.
One of my friends, and I think it's a mutual friend, Matt Sweeney of Laughing Water, really my first mentor in this business. He and I have always chatted about, you know, starting a fund and what it was like for emerging managers, especially kind of one-man shops. And I think it was Luke Wolgram on Twitter asked, or Twitter/X, he asked, you know, thoughts on just starting a fund, when's the right time to attempt it. And I think this is a good question to kind of get your opinion on just, there is really no right time, it seems like, and you're going to have to take a plunge even when you don't feel like you're necessarily quite ready. And, you know, I've gotten Matt's thoughts on it, and I would just love to get your thoughts, like, looking back now 6 years, like, was there ever a quote unquote right time? Did you ever feel ready?
Yeah. I mean, there's a right time for the haves, and then there's a no right time for the have nots, you know? Yeah. And the haves doesn't necessarily, it's not a bad thing. It's just, it's a fortunate thing. Some people have connections. Some people have the right pedigree. Some people have already made a substantial amount of money and they're in the first leg of their career and can afford to kind of launch at scale. And because of the amount of money they've made, they also have the pedigree required to launch at scale. And that's one route. And for those people, you know, good for them. That's great. The have nots are the ones who don't have the ability to launch at scale. And for those, there really is no right time. The odds of success are fairly low. The odds of failure are fairly high. It's scary. It's risky. But if you love it and you think you have what it takes to do it really well, I think the right time, you know, becomes up to you. It's, you know, it's a personal decision based on your lifestyle, based on, you know, your financial position. If you have enough money stashed away where you can live for a few years without making an income, and you have enough money left over after that to put into some vehicle that you could, you know, afford the startup costs on, I think, and you're confident deep down that you could do it really well, right? Like, you really can't get into it, especially at subscale mode, to make money and to try to, like, be successful long term. You have to do it because you really believe you have what it takes to be one of the greats, and you want to do what's right for your partners, because it has to grow organically. And if you're not providing value for your partners by outperforming and you know, or doing something different that they're looking for exposure to, it's really going to be just a long slog for you, and you're not going to feel great about what you're doing. You know, I genuinely, I didn't realize, I guess I didn't appreciate how good I would feel after 6 years for the partners who came in, who are mostly friends, family, word of mouth, people who found me on the internet, who actually don't know what to do with their capital, and that I've generated returns that I'm proud of for. And the feedback I get from them is like, whoa, you turned my retirement money from X to Y. Like, can I give you more? That just feels really good for me. And I genuinely believe, you know, I could do really well over a long period of time for them. You know, I've done it for 6 years. I think I can do it for the next 30. But I think you need a belief in yourself. You need to have, you know, the financial wherewithal to kind of not make money for a few years. And it's hard if you end up starting, you know, timing is everything. You could start at just a weird time, mm-hmm. and that would suck. But, you know, if you have a bunch of opportunities you're really excited about and the wherewithal to do it, I'd say pull the trigger before you have kids, before you have a mortgage, before you have all these obligations that could slow you down.
On those first few conversations, it feels like, just looking from the outside in, it feels like there's this chicken and the egg problem where if you're a stock picker, you, let's say you don't have this pedigree, you don't come from, you know, the traditional investment banking route, Goldman, all that. There's a chicken and the egg where that those first few LPs want to see success or want to see other investors. But in order to get other investors, you need the first few LPs, and you can start to go into like this weird cycle, you know, again, like the chicken and the egg problem. So yeah. What were those initial conversations like, and that initial hurdle of getting, you know, the first few dollars in? And maybe it's a function of just, hey, you know, I had a couple family members that just totally took a bet on me, Yaron, as a person, not necessarily me, Yaron, as this stock picker that thinks they can do really well.
Yeah. I think it is a chicken and the egg if you're trying to get the scaled LPs, you know, who are writing $10, $20 million checks. I think if you're going for the high net worth individuals, I think it's less chicken and the egg. You just need to have enough money to kind of, again, be able to support yourself for a few years without making a living off the fund itself, and enough money to actually put into the fund and support the startup costs. After that, there's no chicken in the egg. It's very easy for friends, families, friends of friends to come in. And that's really how I started building my business. You know, I started the fund with less than $2 million in it. It was a million and change. Most of that was my personal capital, but you know, very early on, a few of my former bosses from different funds I worked for kind of showed a sign of support and put some money in. And over time, that expanded to friends, then friends of friends, and then word of mouth. And now I have people that, you know, I've met through third or fourth degree connections, or they just found me through my Twitter account or whatever, and have come in. And it's you know, we're now over $30 million of assets. It's grown from almost nothing to that. And I'm finally at the scale and with the track record that I think I could genuinely have the conversations with the institutional guys. And hopefully I'm able to land some of them, because I think I could be a great partner for them for the next 20 or 30 years. But I think at some point, if you put up the performance, the, you know, the high net worth individuals who really, they're looking for some, a lot of people, you know, who are just high net worth individual investors don't know how to manage their capital. And that's the part where I feel I feel the best, because those are the ones who come to you and say thank you. I think the true kind of blue chip institutional investors you need them almost as much as they need you as a fund manager. They want someone who's going to put up good returns, but you're going to be a small percentage of their overall portfolio. Even if you crush it, you're not really changing their life or like, you know, but if you do it for the high net worth guys, I think you're providing a ton of value. And that's where I've really felt good about what I've been able to do for them and what I hope I could do for them for the next 30 years. So if you're targeting that, there really is no chicken in the egg. I think you just need to have enough capital to kind of fund your lifestyle for a few years and manage a small pool, and they'll start coming in through trust and word of mouth. If you can articulate why what you're doing works and why it works within the framework of what they're trying to accomplish for the long term.
And when you're starting that portfolio, let's say you get that first outside dollar, you're managing your own money, when it comes to allocating and building a portfolio, starting from scratch, basically, how did you think about portfolio allocation, position sizing? Like, let's say, you know, you want to run a concentrated book of, let's call it 8 to 15 names or whatever, and you've got $1 million in that, you know, LP account, and now you have to spend it. How did that work when you first started, and that you would change about that process when it comes to allocating money to ideas at inception?
Yeah. Everything I did at the beginning was smaller and in a more timid fashion. You know, I knew I was a good business analyst and a good stock picker, and I'd been around portfolio managers, right? I was at two hedge funds that had, you know, slightly similar, slightly variant, you know, differing strategies. I'd read about how other portfolio managers manage their portfolios. I read letters, I listen to podcasts, I watch YouTube interviews. So I had a sense of like what worked for other people. But you, as a first-time portfolio manager, you're really learning what works for you. Mm-hmm. And you don't know how you're going to act in periods of volatility, of economic uncertainty, when you're in the middle of a drawdown. And if you really care about protecting your capital, I think it makes sense to start in a lower risk way And that means smaller position sizes than you think you even want, less overall market exposure, until you've been through a few drawdowns, until you've gained that confidence that you know how you're going to act and you feel like you make good decisions in those periods of volatility and uncertainty. So, my day one portfolio was smaller positions. My biggest positions were high single digit, maybe 10% of the fund. I always ran with 40% cash out of the get-go. I just wanted to have, money to buy the dip when the market pulled back. Mm-hmm. Today, my biggest positions are more than double that. They're 20% type positions. Wow. I definitely do not like running with 40% cash balances anymore. If the cash balance gets over 10-15% of the fund, to the extent I have good ideas, right? If I didn't have good ideas, I would not force the capital into them. But to the extent I have good ideas, I feel like, why am I underinvested? I'm leaving money on the table because I know that I'm a good stock picker, and that cash, if it's deployed into the ideas that I love, will do well over time. I'm much more confident about that. And in terms of just having the ability to buy the dip, you don't really need cash to buy the dip. You can reallocate from names that have held up better into names that sold off more. And if you can reallocate capital, that's kind of like generating cash in periods of volatility and uncertainty. But I think you start everything smaller. I think you do everything, more timidly. And over time, hopefully you're able to gain the confidence that you need to really swing when you see fat pitches and capitalize on volatility when it comes. I think the answer is you learn as you go.
I think there's a very interesting story embedded in that, what you just said, where you started, largest position was maybe 8-10%, and now it's 20% or 20% plus. And again, I'm not saying that's 20% at cost. Maybe you let it run to 20% and that's like your new high. But clearly something changed from when you started to now in terms of just concentration and size. And I wonder, is that just pure confidence in yourself? Is that your ability to analyze a business, your ability to analyze a risk reward? Like, what specifically changed in you to go from, okay, my max is 10% to, okay, my max is 20%?
Yeah. So confidence in myself, that I'm a good business analyst, a good stock picker. The realization that it's very hard to find those best ideas, and that now over 6 years, it's not like they're not a dime a dozen. And so when you're very, very picky and you find stuff that meets the criteria you're looking for, which for me is, I want really good companies with really good balance sheets and really strong and aligned management teams. I want all those things at like 10 times earnings. That's what I'm looking for. Yeah. It's really hard to find those. And I think I'm really good at identifying them when I do find them. And I think I've proven to myself that I don't get too attached to them, and I'm willing to change my mind if the facts change or if I turn out to be wrong, and that I make good decisions even when I'm in the middle of a drawdown. And when I have a big position moving 20 or 30% against me, I can kind of maintain my composure and decide whether it's the market being wrong, whether I still think it's a good investment opportunity, whether I think I've made a mistake, cut my losses. And so the ability to identify them, my confidence in making good decisions around them have all grown. So I just think, and I do want to generate Hall of Fame returns for 30 years. And to do that, you have to be concentrated in the positions that you're most excited about, that you think could deliver the best IRRs. If you want to deliver amazing returns, you could either lever up the alpha you find, or mm-hmm. you can ride the alpha and the beta together, right? It's very hard to hedge out beta over 10, 20, 30 years and outperform the market unless you lever the crap out of your alpha. And I don't like leverage for a variety of reasons. I started my career during the great financial crisis. I saw what businesses had to do when they were levered. I saw what fund managers had to do when they were stopped out at the lows. I just don't like leverage, not on my underlying businesses, not on the portfolio. And so if I really want to just deliver a differentiated return stream to investors, my philosophy is I want to ride alpha and beta together. And the alpha component is hard to find. So when I find it, I just want to own it in size.
And so with that confidence you mentioned, I can almost view the confidence in yourself as a function of increased competency as a business analyst, increased competency as a stock picker. And,
portfolio manager. So business analyst, stock picker, portfolio manager.
Yep. So there's kind of that trifecta underneath that confidence. But one, I guess, problem in air quotes with value investing or any kind of, let's say any sort of investment time horizon longer than 18 to 24 months is it's hard to tell from inception of idea. Let's say you buy an idea. It's hard to tell if you were actually right until sometimes it's 3-5 years down the line. And those are long lead times to kind of recycle and gauge progress. And I think a lot of people listening to this would have the question, and this is a question that I often ask, is what are some tangible ways that I can see improvement in myself that is on a shorter lead time than the result of the decision I make in an investment, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. It really depends on your investment style and philosophy, right? If your style and philosophy is to predict changes in market valuation and multiples of your businesses, that could be very tough to figure out whether you were right for the right reasons or wrong. Because at the end of the day, multiples are psychology, right? When people are feeling really good, multiples go up. When people are feeling really bad, multiples go down. When companies are beating near-term estimates, multiples go up. When companies are missing near-term estimates, multiples go down. It's about what other investors are willing to pay for a business. You're literally trying to predict the psychology of other investors. That's tough, especially because you know you could be riding the momentum of euphoria increasing on the way up, or you know suffering from the momentum if you're long biased, suffering from the negative momentum of euphoria decreasing on the way down. And you might think, oh, I'm just really good at this. I picked, you know, stocks that went up the most. But like you're not really identifying something about the business that you can then gut check and see whether that what you identified was right or wrong. It's more you've been right about how investors are behaving today, which might change tomorrow. Right. My personal style of investing is buying businesses at multiples that I think are already troughish. And if they go lower, I just think it's silly for them to be going to lower multiples. It's possible, obviously psychology could work both ways, but like I'm willing to own them at these multiples. And I think they're worth, you know, significantly higher multiples. And I think they can grow their earnings per share or free cash flow per share at very attractive rates over 3, 4, 5 years. And hopefully over the next 12 months as well, right? Most of my performance has come from names that have significantly grown their earnings per share, free cash flow per share during my ownership period. Mm-hmm. And that's much easier to spot check. Like, did they grow earnings per share, free cash flow per share significantly? And then obviously if you buy stuff at 10 times earnings and they're able to grow earnings at, you know, 15, 20, 25, 30% a year over 3-4 years, hopefully you get multiple expansion too, as market optimism and investor psychology kind of improves on that individual name. You know, the types of businesses I own, I think, have qualities that I think are misunderstood. They're great businesses, good returns on capital, good management team, good balance sheets, but they're still trading at 10 times earnings for some reason I think I can identify and that I think is wrong. And as they grow their earnings per share and free cash flow per share, my hope is that investors can wake up to the quality of the business and I get multiple expansion, but I don't need that. I don't need multiple expansion. So it's much easier for me to be like, okay, did earnings per share grow a lot? And if it did, and the stock didn't move, then the multiple is down even further from what I thought was achieved multiple, and it sucks, but I'm confident they're going to keep growing. Eventually the multiple will stop going down and the stock will go up. Like if a company is growing, if you're buying something at 10 times earnings and it can grow earnings a lot, eventually it's trading at 5 times earnings, then 4 times earnings, then 3 times earnings. And then it's not going to trade for -2 times earnings. Eventually the stock will start going up. So really what I'm focused on is that, the fundamentals, the earnings per share, free cash flow per share. And that's much easier to focus on when you're buying high quality businesses with good management teams that aren't doing dumb things with their cash, they have good balance sheets. And that's kind of why I've gravitated towards this type of strategy.
And when you're looking at these companies that, you know, like you said, they've got good management teams, good balance sheets, good businesses, and you try to get them at discounted prices, usually the reason you can get them at discounted prices is because there's some issue that everyone thinks is structural that maybe you think is temporary, just kind of as a generalization. And so when it comes to like gauging how you've improved as a business analyst, Is part of that just being able to identify more quickly, like, hey, I think this is temporary, or hey, I think this is structural, and then just being like saying no quicker to ideas that maybe 6 years ago you would have sharpened the pencil and spent months on?
Absolutely. I think part of being a good portfolio manager is filtering a ton of information, getting to answers more quickly on the no's, and focusing all your time on the potential yeses. And I've definitely gotten way better at that. You know, when I started in investing, I would sometimes spend literally 5-6 hours on a company before bringing it up to someone else as something I spent 5 or 6 hours on. And I'm like, oh, maybe this is interesting. And they would immediately say one thing that I would go check on, or I didn't even need to check on. I just knew, disqualified as an investment. And I'm like, what did I just do? And I'd be embarrassed. I would be embarrassed a little bit. Now it's rare that that happens to me. I normally spend the time up front, a very small amount of time up front, to try to disqualify things from the obvious. And then it's spending a lot of time on the unobvious, on the nuance, which it's, you know, the nuance is like, either you can get there on, you spend a lot of time, or you just don't get there on. But there's no like absolute no. It's either like a, it's either a yes or a, I'm not convicted enough. So most of the stuff on my watch list, that's kind of where I shake out on them. Either yes or a, not good enough. It's rare that I put something on the watch list, spend a lot of time, and then I find a no, I cannot invest in this. Where in it, when I started, I would find those things. Now, the other thing you said was, you know, usually there's something structural that, you know, the market thinks is structural that I think is temporary. That's not always the case. You know, sometimes it's just a framing of how the market perceives something. And it's not like, oh, this business is structurally broken, but you know what? This business deserves a low multiple right now because of X or Y or Z. It's structurally broken. It's just, you know, you could pitch the same idea 10 different ways. Yeah. And 9 times, and this happens to me too. People pitch ideas to me 9 times and I'm like, that doesn't resonate. And then someone just pitches it a slightly different way on the 10th time. And I'm like, man, that clicks. Like, I get it. Now I could work on this idea because I understand it. And so I think having that kind of perspective to try to frame things differently until like a Rubik's cube, until like it kind of fit within one of your mental models also really helps. And obviously,
do you have an example of that? Sorry to cut you off, but do you have an example of that where someone pitched you a company, and this could be a prior holding, you don't have to mention the name, but you know, it could be a holding where, like like you said, you got pitched 9 times and then somebody said, hey, have you thought about it this way? And it completely changed the way you viewed it.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like the alts I've been pitched 9 times and a 10th time I said, yeah. It's just that the alts, you know, I don't think anyone ever thought the alts were structurally broken businesses. They just thought they were worthy of low multiples because the carry was volatile and they've grown so much already and they own levered beta. And I really think like the more time I spent thinking about them, and it took time to really spend the time thinking about them, right? I worked in private equity. I understood how great of businesses these are over time, but really just spending time thinking about, you know, what is the management fee stream worth? What is the growth potential of it? How should I think about the cyclicality of these businesses, right? Sometimes they raise a ton of money. Sometimes they raise no money. Sometimes they have a ton of exits. Sometimes they don't have any exits in a given year. So carry could be huge, it could be small, but really just thinking about how to value them, how to think about the cyclicality of the business. And I eventually got comfortable with the fact that carry, basically everything trails the long-term performance of these to investors, right? If long-term performance is good, if you think they're good stewards of capital and they already have this blue chip kind of reputation and money is already flowing to the alts, if they continue delivering decent returns to investors, their AUM will continue to grow. Now, there might be cyclicality around that, but it's a secular grower if you believe they can put up good returns. And then carry is super volatile, yes. But carry should, through cycle, trail AUM. The more money you manage, the more carry you could earn. Yeah, it might be zero 1 year, but really it should trail, you know, and if you believe they could put up decent performance, you should believe through cycle carry is worth almost as much as management fees, because they literally go in tandem, right? There might be more cyclicality around it, but like on a through cycle basis, they should almost trail them each other almost exactly, right? If you look at like a 3-year average carry or a 5-year average carry and compare it to AUM, it should trail, AUM growth almost exactly. And so just thinking about the alts from that perspective really allowed me to get comfortable with the fact that these were really cheap because everyone was worried about kind of near-term numbers. If you look at the multi-decade history of these, they've generated good performance. AUM has been up and to the right. Carry's been up and to the right. Management fees have been up and to the right. And they all used to trade at 10 times earnings because of kind of this near-term dynamic. And if no one said these are broken businesses, they were just like, oh, these stocks won't work, right? That's too volatile. It's, yep. AUM, is unpredictable. Management fees go up, and then they stop going up and they go up and carry can go to zero. And they've all re-rated in a meaningful way. So not only did you get the long-term earnings growth of these businesses, but you got the multiple expansion as well. And I think framing things differently until they can click within, the context of your investment style or philosophy, could be helpful. And, every big position I own, I think is worth 15 or 20 or 25 times earnings, but trades at 10 times earnings usually. And normally I could put my finger exactly on why I think the market is wrong. It's not always because the market thinks these are broken businesses. Sometimes it's just they're misunderstanding the growth opportunity that the businesses have.
When you look back over the last 6 years, you've had obviously a lot of winners. There's been losers in there, I'm sure. If you look at the losers, if we just kind of siphon off those, have you noticed any patterns or commonalities of why those stocks ended up not working? And if so, what lessons did you learn from maybe that cohort of underperformers?
Sometimes the thesis just changes. Sometimes I was wrong on my assumptions, and I might have been too optimistic of my assumptions coming in, which sometimes is my fault. Sometimes it's just market dynamics changing. And then sometimes it's been sacrificing on management quality and or alignment. Yeah. And so those are really the reasons I've been burnt. Sacrificing on management quality and or alignment, being overly optimistic in my assumptions, or just dynamics changing about the company or the end market in the midst of my investment. It's rare that it's been pure valuation, right? Where I've been right on the business, right on the management team, and the business just derates from 10 times earnings to like 5 times earnings, and then it goes to 4 and 3, and I've lost money and I'm mad because earnings are going up and management's doing the right thing. It's just rare. Like, yeah, I've had frustrating periods of 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, 24 months of that happening. I've been in business 6 years now. Normally those have ended up being flat for 2 or 3 years, and then they go up 100% in a year or something like that. If they're growing earnings and they're doing the right things with their cash and they have a good management team, I've gained increased confidence that when those things are flat for 2 or 3 years, but everything's going the right direction, I've gotten more patient and added to those positions. But
I think the too optimistic mention is something I struggled with in 2021.
We all did.
Yeah, and it was something where, and this also goes into your discussion on multiple and kind of focusing on multiple and anchoring a bit your valuation on some sort of multiple 3 to 5 years out. And I mean, the amount of times where I would just take a business and just say, oh yeah, it could grow 20% over the next 3 to 5 years on average. And then like, oh yeah, that'll trade at 5x sales. It's like, man, like, and the crazy thing was, is like 5x sales was not expensive. Like a couple of years ago, that was a reasonable multiple. And it took me making a lot of mistakes, and thank goodness I was able to make the mistakes and not lose a ton of money, which I think is incredibly valuable. If you can make all the mistakes without losing a bunch of money, that's like, it's basically getting an MBA for free if you can do it right. But I had to go back to guys like Jeremy Raper, and even some of the more like credit focused analyst investors that I follow that have such an anchor on downside protection. And I think that's something, and you can chime in on this as well, because I'd love to get your thoughts. But like, I feel like I went from trying to be optimistic about an upside and finding my IRR in an upside case versus now it's trying to really understand the downside and finding my IRR in a downside case where the stock price is already assuming these kind of worst case or bear case scenarios, if that makes sense.
Yeah, look, downside protection comes from either a deep discount to net liquidation value with a management team that's willing to realize net liquidation value and liquidate their business, which is like very rare. Maybe an activist makes them do it, but management teams normally don't want to fire themselves by shutting their businesses down, or by buying a durable business that can be, you know, grow in line with GDP or better at a multiple well below the market multiple, right? By definition, if you could buy an earnings stream that mirrors the S&P 500, but it comes from one company, or you could buy the S&P 500, you would always buy the S&P 500 because you're way more diversified. And so a business that just mirrors the S&P 500 in terms of earnings growth should always trade at a discount to the S&P 500, always.
Mm-hmm.
It has more customer concentration, it has more end market concentration. It can get disintermediated with a new product or service that puts it out of business. Like, it could go to zero. The S&P 500 cannot go to zero. And so there is gravity on multiples to a sub S&P 500 multiple, even for a business that you think you can't kill today, that looks durable today. There's gravity. It's always going to trade down to, over time, a below S&P 500 multiple. And that's if you can't kill it today. If you think you could kill it today, the multiple can go super low. Then people start valuing it on DCF or earnings revisions. And it can go, and if you have bad management on top of that, then there's no valuation support and people are just like, they're going to burn all the cash trying to turn this business around. And so, yeah, valuations are gravity. And I think too many people assume some exit multiple a few years out that is well above the S&P 500 just because that's where something's traded historically. And I think you can get in trouble doing that. That's kind of why, you know, I like buying things at 10 times earnings that I think could grow earnings a lot. I think, you know, the market historically is 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20 times earnings, depending on, you know, how excited investors are at any given moment. But I'm buying businesses that I think could significantly outgrow the market. And if I'm right, they'll eventually hopefully trade up from 10 to 15 times earnings and I'll get the earnings growth as well. I try to stay away from the liquidation at asset value stories. I would look at them if I thought it was the right situation and opportunity. But I think those are really the two ways you can protect capital is, mm-hmm. And you know, if not, you're a trader, which is fine too. Otherwise you're just a trader, which is fine too. But if you're a trader, don't get married to investments. Don't, right? Like, you're trading them. If the thesis isn't working, get out. And I think too many people in 2021, look, in 2021, everyone, including myself, was trying to convince themselves to find reasons to buy the stocks that were going up the most because everyone was getting drunk at the party and you know, Kool-Aid looked tasty. And so we all convinced ourselves to be overly optimistic on the types of names that seemed to be going up the most. Fortunately, I didn't do too much of that, but everyone did it to some extent. And I think as an investor, it behooves you to realize when you made a mistake, learn from it, change your mind, protect your capital, and not repeat that mistake the next time that situation arises. And that's all you can do as an investor. I agree with you 100%. If you could learn your mistakes in a low cost way, it's a free MBA. And that's how we all improve as investors over time.
What are some things when you look out over, let's say, over the next 6 years? So you've had tremendous success these, you know, kind of, we'll call it the first 6 years. And if you move forward the next 6 years, what are some things that you want to do, you know, just achieve Hall of Fame returns, but personally and maybe professionally, like, what are some ways that you want to get better? Is it you want to learn about more industries? Do you want to go deeper on specific things? Like, what are you trying to do so that you can generate those Hall of Fame returns over the next 6 years?
Yeah, I mean, look, first of all, I'm more invested today than I was at the beginning. I'm more concentrated in my best ideas than I was in the beginning. I think those two fact patterns alone hopefully allow me to deliver better outperformance relative. Right, you can't predict what the market will do, but you can hopefully outperform the market and hopefully generate, you know, better performance over the next 6 years than I generated over the last six. And I think I'll do that. The other thing is that's up to me is just continue to increase the velocity of ideas I'm able to look at, right? The more things you could look at, the more quickly and more favorably you can kind of high grade your portfolio. And as I scale, I hope to add an analyst to the team to kind of help me look at more things. I think naturally, as people get older and they have kids and their asset base grows, there's this natural kind of tension that pushes them to become more lazy over time, right? Like, you're making more money by working less hard and you have more things calling on you outside of work. Mm-hmm. And my goal is to fight that attrition of laziness, because I really want to do this well for the next 30 years. And that's hard for people to do, right? Like, most people, as they become more successful and older, kind of check out more. And I want to fight that. I want to do this well for the next 30 years. I want to be a Hall of Famer. And most of the LPs who are invested with me today, this is meaningful money for them, where I could change the course of their retirement. And they're people who I have deep, meaningful relationships with. So I also, for selfish reasons, I just want to be a Hall of Famer. Like, I want to be known as one of the greats. So that's the goal, is just keep going through lots of ideas, finding better ones to replace the ones that, that are currently in the portfolio, and continuing to refine the process. I think the process that I have today in terms of stock selection, portfolio management, position sizing is way better than it was 6 years ago. And I think I'm sure there will be more tweaks along the way. I think the steepest part of my learning curve I think I've got through in 6 years, but I'm sure I'm going to keep learning and refining mm-hmm. along the way as well.
So what does that daily process look like for you now? Like, let's say you wake up, you read the news, read filings, read reports. Like, what does that process look like, and how much time is spent on your, what you own versus what you might own or new ideas?
I spend a lot of time on what I own. I talk most of the companies that are in the portfolio, I'm talking to a few times a quarter, meeting with face-to-face once a quarter, hopefully. I'm trying to talk to the customers, suppliers, any industry people that, are on top of the industry to make sure I'm not missing anything. SEC filings, K's and Q's come out. I try to read those, from end to end, but at least the important part, the parts that I find to be important every quarter. And so listening to earnings calls, if companies are presenting at conferences, listening to that, that takes a lot of time. And then doing all that on the watch list, right, which are the names where I haven't thrown out yet, I've spent a lot of time on, and I just haven't gotten to yes yet, but there's no immediately disqualifying thing, so staying on top of those, and then obviously trying to find new ones, and trying to run the business as well. I brought on Willow Oak, I partnered with them earlier this year. They've nice. Taken a lot of the operations and kind of IR stuff off my plate, which lets me spend more of that incremental time on new ideas. And then hopefully, as I continue to scale, I could add, an analyst to the team to help me go through more ideas as well. But that's kind of my day to day. There really is no average day. During earnings seasons, it's one way. Outside of earnings season, I could be spending an entire day on a new idea if I found one that I'm really excited about. Or if there's, nothing that new and pressing and exciting, I could be spending the entire day on existing portfolio, talking to other investors about names that, that I own that they're interested in. So there's no real average day, but that's kind of how I spend my time.
And then for new idea generation, how has that process changed from when you started 6 years ago?
I get to know much more quickly. I know when names could be disqualified very quickly for me. Just because a name can't be quickly disqualified doesn't mean it will or won't make its way into the portfolio. Then the nuance begins of trying to get to yes.
Right.
Or just keeping it on the watch list and figuring out like how I could get to yes, or how I could, just decide it's not for me. And then quickly throwing things out, it's become easier. I don't like leverage, but if a company does have leverage, I can quickly decide if that business model should be able to support that type of leverage, right? I own Dental Corp. It's 4x leveraged. That's higher than almost any business I've owned, 4x yeah. leverage. But they own dental practices, over 500 of them. It's a very stable, cash generative business, not economically sensitive. But just 4x leverage on that doesn't tell me my answer of whether I'm comfortable with 4x leverage or not. Mm-hmm. When are the maturities? What are the covenants? Is it fixed or floating rate debt? Is it bond or bank debt, right? Stuff like that. I go in, but you can see all that fairly quickly in investments, and scanning proxies. how much of the company does management own? How are they compensated? Owning a small percentage of the company doesn't always mean they're not aligned. You just want them to suffer when the stock price is going down and to celebrate when the stock price is going up. And so, if they own no stock but they get compensated very well if the stock goes up and their job is on the line if the stock goes down, like that could be great alignment also. But just trying to understand the alignment and trying to understand the end market, business quality, right? Like, is it an oligopoly? Is it a completely fragmented market? If it's fragmented, it doesn't mean they can't earn high returns on capital, but like, what's the moat? What are the returns on capital? How do they defend them? How do they grow the business? I like these companies that are able to grow earnings per share, free cash flow per share. How are they doing that? How are they deploying capital? What's the organic growth profile of the business? So really drilling in on kind of those things early on, as opposed to just looking at valuation, right? Like, yes, I want things that trade at a below market multiple, but the more important thing is not how much below the market multiple, but how much can they grow earnings per share, free cash flow per share. When I started investing, I would just look for the biggest discount to market multiple. two times EBIT, I would be like, oh my God, this is so cheap, I need to spend time on it. And usually there's a reason if it's too discounted, and you might be able to disagree with that reason and then it's a great investment, but usually that reason is pretty well analyzed and studied. It's the ones that are at a slight discount to the market, 10, 20, 30, 40% discount to the market, that I think for me have been the best hunting grounds over time.
Yeah, that is funny how the massive discounts are usually not great ideas, but the ones that are maybe 15 to 20% discounted. It reminds me of Ferguson, the plumbing distributor. Yeah. And they were at one point I had, I think it was Jeremy Kokomar on the podcast, and he pitched it. And at that time it was trading at, I want to say, less than 9 times next year's profits at that time. And it kind of fit that bill. It was like, this seems like an above average business trading at a below average multiple.
Yeah.
And that's done very well. I was fortunate enough to buy that after him and I pitched it, and I ended up visiting one of their distribution centers here in Maryland. And I was like, yeah, this doesn't really make sense. I think this should trade at the market or a little bit above. And it happened to be a LSE listing that converted to a, US listing. And it was, kind of everything aligned. And then it made me realize when that idea worked, I'm like, man, why don't I just wait for ideas like that? And just fill my portfolio with ideas like that. And it sounds so obvious, saying it out loud, but in practice, I find it very difficult to wait for those ideas that seem obvious, because the entire time in between then, it's almost like I get this anxious feeling like I'm doing nothing, that I need to be doing something. And I don't know if you've struggled with that. Maybe you struggled with that 6 years ago and it's gotten a lot better, but I can't be the only one that thinks like that.
No, I think the younger you are, the less patient you are. Yeah. And I heard someone else say that recently. I forgot on which pod, but it's ironic that the older you get, the less time you actually have to appreciate the fruits of your labor, but the more patient and long-term oriented you become as an investor. When you're young, you just want to make money now. You want to make quick decisions. You want to, if a stock's down 15%, you just want to buy it because you're like, oh my God, this is an opportunity, without trying to understand why it's down 15 and whether it might go down another 15 or whether it's, a bad reaction to something stupid. The older you get, the more people that you really respect pitch you something and you're just like, I don't think it's good enough yet. I don't think it's good enough yet. It's on my radar. I don't think it's good enough yet. And then eventually you could swing, And that could be valuation. That could be your conviction about the business growing over time as you're studying it, because someone you respect is telling you to look at it, and you're looking at it, but you don't fully understand it. And you spend more, right? The more time you spend listening to companies talk about their business, the more you kind of comprehend what they're saying. The first time it sounds like gibberish. The second time you're like, I think I get it. Third time you're like, man, this makes sense. And so I think patience to fully understand the opportunity, and or patience for a much better entry price are both very important if you want to do well over time. And the older you get, for some reason, at least for me, I'm just so much more patient. Like, I make less decisions now, and I bet that in 5 years I'll make even less decisions than I did day one. So
I had an investor that ran a one-man partnership here in Annapolis, has since moved to Florida, and he is an older guy, 60-ish, maybe 65, and he buys one new company maybe every 2 years, and that's his thing. And he's outperformed the market over 30 years, so that's awesome. it's incredible. But like, I remember meeting him for the first time, and him and I couldn't have been more different. I was reading every single filing, trying to find every idea, trying to fit every, you know, square idea into a round peg. And he was just sitting there, and he's like, no, it's not better than what I own.
Yeah. And it's also easier when you have a more seasoned portfolio, because when you have a more seasoned portfolio, you already have a bigger percentage of your AUM allocated to kind of anchor positions that you don't feel the need to sell or upgrade, because they're already they're top notch. So really you're looking to reallocate capital from your 5% positions, your 4% positions, not your 20% positions, which means, you know, there's just less capital. There's more ideas competing for a smaller amount of capital, and you could just be more patient. And so I do think the quality of my ideas as the portfolio has become more seasoned have gotten better, and the bar for displacing the existing names in the portfolio has just gotten higher, which is fun, because it just lets you be patient and say no to things and spend time understanding what you own better and really kicking tires on things that could displace, but you don't need tons of them. You just need to find, to your point, one a year, two a year, and you really try to turn over a lot of rocks until you find them. This year, my two new and big kind of ideas, Dental Corp was one, and then SP Plus was the other, and that's a great year. And then SP got bought out, which at the day it got announced, I was really excited. It was a 45% premium. Nice. And now I think back, I'm that sucks. You know, I'm never going to complain about making, four or 5% in a day. Yeah. But it really would have been a great kind of long-term position that I spent a lot of time getting to know management. I flew out to see them in Chicago. I spent a lot of time speaking to them, understanding the business, and then it's just the opportunity kind of now I needed to find a new home for that capital.
I remember there was a company, the ticker symbol was eGov, and they basically did government software, back-end software, mm-hmm. for Department of Wildlife and all that stuff. And I remember doing a bunch of work on them, thinking they were super cheap, and we bought them. And then a month or two later, Tyler Technologies bought them for a 25-30% premium. And it was the same sort of thing. It was oh, that's kind of cool, but I did a lot of work and I thought it was undervalued. I thought I would be able to hold that for a long time. Yep. And now I can't.
Right. Yeah. I think it just makes it easier to get more patient, to your point, as you have a more seasoned portfolio. Yeah. I hope to find another two great ideas next year. We'll see.
So with Dental Corp, how did you find that? And what was your process? Yeah, I don't know if you had any pre-existing knowledge on, dental practices, but walk us through how you got up to speed and then ended up developing conviction.
Yeah, so my pre-existing knowledge on dental practices goes back to studying some of the dental distributors and some of the dental equipment manufacturers, Dentsply Sirona, Henry Schein, Patterson. They've historically traded at relatively below market multiples. The end market is great, right? People don't stop filling cavities and cleaning their teeth during downturns. And so they've just been a very steady, stable, growing end market. I got to know the dental business better when I met my now wife. Her dad, so now my father-in-law, is a dentist. He had a few practices. And I being as interested in business as I am, even before there was a publicly listed DSO, I've always kind of talked to him about his business, tried understanding, the pros, the cons, how to operate. you know, the business, and I've really gotten a good understanding of how these businesses operate. And, you know, he's approaching retirement, and he's always kind of talked to me about, you know, what he's thinking when he's getting ready to retire. There's a developed DSO market in the US, and you could either sell to a DSO, or you could find a new partner dentist to kind of sell your practice and, you know, gradually down to over time. And so I've understood the psychology around it, the operations of the business. You know, fast forward to early 2023, someone pitched me DentalCorp, which I hadn't heard of until this year. Might have been late last year, early this year. It was a DSO based in Canada that, you know, went public in 2021. Basically had a brief period where people liked the stock, and then it just kind of started cratering. DSOs are really good businesses. So it came public at a full valuation. And the reason the stock went down over the course of 2022 and this year, to me, are very identifiable. And I think they have very little to do with the underlying quality of the business. You know, a few things happened. First of all, the dynamics around low float, small cap, levered companies has just been horrible, especially off US exchanges, right? So this is Canadian listed, small cap. The sponsor still owns, between sponsor and management, they still own like half the company or something. So like you have half the float locked up.
Yep.
It trades like, you know, $1 million, $2 million bucks a day on a good day. So it's low trading volume, 4x levered, and interest rates were going up. So that's not good for small companies that have interest expense. And the underlying business saw not insignificant margin compression over the last couple of years. There's two reasons why they saw the margin compression on a same store basis. One was labor costs. Well, inflation across the board, but labor is the biggest chunk of the cost base of a dental practice. And so, you know, hygienist salaries and dental assistant salaries and, you know, practice manager salaries all inflated, and they weren't able to, dental practices reprice their business. They change, you know, their pricing once a year, but the salaries can go up intra-year. If you need to replace a hygienist intra-year, you can get repriced intra-year. The consumables that they're using to actually do procedures on your mouth also get repriced intra-year. So they got caught offside by inflation 2 years in a row where they took price up less than inflation ended up shaking out. And then the other thing is they made some investments in IT and other corporate, SG&A leading into the IPO and post-IPO that caused a deleverage. So practice level margins went down on the same store basis, and corporate went down even more because of these G&A investments. And so you had higher, you know, bad dynamics for the stock. They were missing numbers because same store margins were going down and they were deleveraging G&A. They were also missing free cash flow numbers because interest expense went up. And then they also missed numbers because they raised, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in the IPO at a good valuation. And they said they were going to put it to work to buy more practices at good valuation. But then practice multiples went up temporarily during 20, you know, everyone was euphoric in 21 and 22, early 22, including dentists who single dentists were bidding for new practices at what are now, you know, obviously silly multiples. And DentalCorp, because they said they were going to raise a bunch of money to deploy into M&A, they deployed capital at multiples that were too high. So what that led to is they bought less EBITDA per dollar raised in the IPO than people expected. So they basically missed numbers for 2 years. But the quality of the business stayed really high. They were still generating a lot of cash. And all those things, I think, are turning now. First of all, they fixed 3/4 of their debt. So 3/4 of their interest expense is fixed, and rates have started rolling, you know, into the end of 2023. Inflation is chilling out, and this coming year, I think they're going to take more price than their costs are going up, and they're going to leverage G&A. So same store margins are going to go back up, plus they're going to leverage G&A, and multiples on practices have come back down to earth. So, you know, historically we were buying practices at 6x EBITDA, then it went up to 7x EBITDA in 2021 and 2022. All of a sudden you're paying like 11x EBITDA for single practices, which was nuts. Now they're back to 7x EBITDA. And so these guys are generating 140, 150 million dollars a year of free cash flow, they're going to be deploying that into M&A at 7x EBITDA while their margins are going to stop going down and going to start going up again. And interest expense, most of it's fixed, but rates have actually come down. So the quarter that's unfixed is actually going to improve. And so I think numbers are going to start moving in the right direction again, relative to consensus estimates. And because it's a low float illiquid stock, the same dynamics that hurt it on the way down, I think help it on the way back up. It's low float, so it doesn't take a lot of buying to move it. And once the stock starts to go back up, I do think there's going to be an increase in the liquidity because the sponsor and management will be selling down their shares over time as the stock gets back to a more fair price. And as the volume and liquidity improves, I think bigger funds will be able to look at it. And then, you know, when a company has higher trading value and bigger funds could look at it, it tends to have a lower cost of capital, both equity and debt. And so I think, the multiple single digit free cash flow multiple now, I think you don't need multiple expansion. You just need them to grow same store sales, same store clinic, revenues 3-4% like they always have historically. Margins don't go down. Hopefully they start going back up, and then spending their free cash flow to buy more practices at 7x EBITDA. That formula gets you to double digit free cash flow per share growth. I think well more than 10%, but let's just 15-20% free cash flow per share growth. Mm-hmm. And if the multiple stays at 9x free cash flow and you're growing free cash flow 20% a year, the stock will go up 20% a year until it gets back to a price where you get secondaries, and then hopefully you can get the multiple expansion. I think this is a utility-like business, very, very stable in economic, in various economic cycles. And I think it's worthy of a market-like multiple. At least in the period where it's able to grow at well above market rates, right? Like I said, once a business hits maturity, it's always worth less than a market multiple. But if they can grow free cash flow per share at 20% a year for the next 20 years in the near term, it is worth a higher than market multiple until it reaches that mature state. And so I think this could trade at 20x free cash flow. So I think the multiple is worth 2x where it trades for today. I think what you're applying the multiple to will probably double or triple over the coming years as they deploy their free cash flow and grow the margins of the underlying business. And it's just a really good business at a good valuation. I actually met with management yesterday. They said if they sold every practice they owned at current market at multiples, 7 to 7.5x EBITDA, which is what they're buying single practices at now. If they just liquidated this and sold all the individual practices they own 500 and change, then they would probably be left with $9.50. The stock's at $6. So liquidation value of this is $9.50. And normally platforms trade at a higher multiple than the underlying assets they're buying because you have more diversification, you have more scale. And these, scale DSOs trade at 14x EBITDA all the time in private markets. So this is at a discount to its liquidation value, at a discount to its private market value, at a discount to what it's probably worth in public markets. And I think it's going to grow a lot. It's just kind of checked all the boxes I'm looking for.
So it's got, and again, I'm looking on TradingView, but it looks like a market cap of, call it, 1.2 billion.
Yep.
500 stores, 2.4 million a store. And so, yeah, I mean, I kind of like theses like that, where you can break it down on a store by store basis and say they could sell these stores for $3.5 million each. And they're trading at, the market's valuing them at 2.4. But when you look at management, they do the IPO and they say, hey, we're going to use this IPO cash to buy these dental practices at, good, attractive prices. And then you see them buy at suboptimal prices. Is that something where it's like, hey, that's one strike and then a couple more, maybe you lose trust? Or was that something where management kind of telegraphed and they said, hey, like, that was our bad, if we did it over again, maybe we would have just kept the cash and waited for the multiples to come down?
I'm a pretty vocal shareholder. Normally I'm a straight shooter. Like, I tell management teams the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I think a lot of them respect me for it, and I develop good rapport and relationships with them. And I gave this feedback to them. And at first they were like, I don't know. At the time we were trading at, 15-16x EBITDA. So like buying stuff at 11 wasn't really like that dumb. And like, I've said it a few more times and they've come around to it. I think they now fully agree that they could have just waited and done nothing with the cash. look, we all made mistakes in 2021. The market was rewarding us for doing dumb things with cash. And just like I would expect an LP to evaluate me on my long-term performance and my ability to identify mistakes and improve from them, I would hope that management, you know, that management teams are the same. They learn, they improve, and you can't knock a management team for getting caught up in something once, especially when they have a long history of creating a lot of value. I mean, they've built this from scratch at very low multiples, right? They've self-funded a lot of the growth. They've created a lot of value for themselves and for their shareholders over time because they got caught up over a period where, like, they were probably getting mixed signals from their bankers, from some shareholders who wanted them to grow really fast at any price, and from their stock price. And so we all make mistakes. We learn from them. I don't think their mistake was fatal. It's not like they they levered up the company to 6x or 7x EBITDA to go buy stuff at those multiples. They just kind of used the cash they raised at IPO. And I think they're very aligned. I think they recognize the mistake. I think they're good operators. And, you know, I think the stock's way too cheap here. So,
yeah, I mean, I guess buying stuff, buying assets at 11x, 12x EBITDA, if that's like you going wild in a crazy environment, that's probably not the worst thing.
It was with cash you raised to do M&A, you know, and the market was telling you do M&A. At the time, like, you could have argued if you do more M&A, your multiple will go up because you're going to grow EBITDA faster, even if your leverage is, right, not going down.
Yeah,
it would have been the wrong argument, but like I could see shareholders making that argument. Now, I wouldn't have made that argument at the time. I wasn't involved. I didn't follow the company at the time. But I could see investors making that argument at the time, and I could see management hearing it and being like, okay, they gave us this cash. We told them we were going to do it. We have to do it. I think it was a mistake in hindsight, but not, you know, there are management teams that made much worse mistakes in that period than these guys did.
It's almost like the private equity approach in the sense where you're trying to buy assets to gain scale so that you become more attractive as like a takeover or takeout or something. And it kind of reminds me of like the car wash business, where that's like another kind of, you can go, you know, car wash by car wash. And I've got a family member that's trying to do something similar, and they're, you know, they went from buying car washes at 4x to 5x EBITDA. Now they're paying 11x, 12x. Mm-hmm. And his rationale for that is, look, we just need size so that someone like a Mr. Car Wash can come buy us out because we have a larger portfolio. And like, I kind of understand that, but that's also a pretty dangerous game to play.
Yeah. So if you're buying something to then sell it like a hot potato, it's a dangerous game to play. I think if you're buying a dental practice at 7x EBITDA, that's basically, you know, a 14% pre-tax yield on your investment. Assuming it was fully equity funded, right? You're making 14% pre-tax. Let's just say that's like 11% after tax. That's unlevered. You're going to use some leverage. Your cost of debt is below the 14% pre-tax or 11% after tax. So your ROE is going to be well into the teens if you're using leverage. And it's a business that, so let's say you're earning 15% and there's no growth, right? Which there is growth in these. They tend to grow over time on a same store basis. It's like, okay, if there was no growth, you're earning teens on this practice, and the cost of capital for this business is, you know, is well below that, I think. And then you get the added diversification, right? Geographic diversification. You're able to leverage, as a platform, you're able to leverage your corporate G&A over time and deliver synergies to these practices, right? You have scale. You can better negotiate with the distributors. You could better... have best practices deployed across all your locations to improve patient experience, to improve efficiency, to have better training, better retention, better hiring practices. You can really improve these businesses, and you're not really relying on flipping it to like dumb money to make a good return. Like you're buying these evaluations where you're already making a good return on day one at these prices. So I don't think it's a game of hot potato. I think like, this business should be worthy of a higher multiple on a consolidated basis than it is on the individual practice level. And that's my thesis. We'll see if it's right in a few years, but I'm pretty confident I'll make a good return on this investment. We'll see.
Yeah. I mean, I'm about to go to a dentist literally in 20-25 minutes, and I have to replace a retainer, and it's going to cost like probably $300, and it's going to the technician's going to take maybe 15, 20 minutes to scan my mouth. And it's like pretty solid business there. If you pay a technician 35, you know, even 35, 40 bucks an hour, you charge $200, $300 for a retainer. You know, it's
material costs on that are not very high. And the labor costs for 15 minutes are not very high.
A lot of people pay cash, I think, for dental services. It's not necessarily a lot of insurance related things.
In the US, there's more insurance, but it's still a lot of cash pay, but there's more insurance. In Canada, it's almost all cash pay. So it's a great business at a good price that I think will grow, is durable, it's stable. I think there's very little disintermediation risk, very little obsolescence risk, right? AI is like, these are the types of things that like you say and they sound good, but they actually are meaningful to like how confident you could be in an investment, right? Yes. Businesses that like, you know, will be around for the next 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. Like these are good businesses. There's so many businesses where like, you know what the next five look like, but you can't say with confidence that they're going to be around in 20 years, right? Like anything you do in front of a computer today, I could argue who knows how quickly AI is going to develop and eliminate the need for that thing, whatever it is you do in front of a computer.
Literally every B2B SaaS productivity tool.
Exactly. It's just like, it's impossible to say for sure. Now you can make the argument AI will help them. You can make the argument AI will hurt them, but no one really knows. And as soon as numbers stop going up, people will assume the worst, right? Like people only are willing to ignore the long-term risks when numbers are going up. As soon as numbers stop growing at these attractive rates, like people then start focusing on why should I own this risk, right? They ignore that risk because they want to own the growth up front. But as soon as the growth slows down, people start focusing on why should I own this risk? Mm. And so buying stuff at low multiples that don't have those risks de-risks you as an investor.
I think what you said there was great, where people, you come for the growth, but when stuff starts going south, then you start worrying about downside. Yeah. And a successful investment really should be the opposite of that, or the inverse. Awesome. Well, Yaron, we've got maybe a couple minutes left. What other corners of the markets are you looking at? What stuff is on your desk now? What are you excited about? Potential investments for next year?
Yeah, I mean, my top three investments are very chunky. They make up well over half the fund at this point. So those are IWG, Dental Corp, Limbach. I spent a lot of time on each of those to make sure I'm not missing anything and my view of the business and opportunity haven't changed. I'm also spending time on obviously the smaller ideas that are working their way up the portfolio and the watch list. But those are the ones I'm most excited about into 2024. I feel really optimistic that, 2024 could be a good year for these smaller names that have been beaten up due to economic sensitivity worries and interest rate exposure and the like. So we'll see. Hopefully the optimism isn't for naught. And we'll do a catch up in 2024 and see how each of those played out.
Yeah, let's do it. So thanks so much again. Last question I've got two questions I've got for you. First one, where can people go to find you? We've got a website, Twitter. Yep. What's the handle?
One Main Capital.
There it is. And that's the number one, not spelled out.
And Main, M-A-I-N, not man.
That's right. And then the final question, and I didn't.
Although I am One Man Capital also, but.
A double entendre. So last question I've got, I didn't go back and listen to the first answer you had, I think a couple of years ago, but if you could have dinner with anyone from the past or the present, who would it be and why?
I don't remember what I said last time.
This episode is brought to you by Ticker. Ticker.com is focused on bringing institutional level investment research to you, the individual investor. Ticker.com is powered by S&P Global Capital IQ and has coverage of over 50,000 stocks globally with financial data, estimates, valuation metrics, ownership percentages, transcript filings, news, and more. ValueHive listeners can join Ticker's free beta trial today at ticker.com/hive. That's TIKR.com/hive.